I invite you to open your Bibles to Luke 22 as we continue our walk through the last portion of Luke's Gospel. I want to begin with a question. Have you ever found yourself fallen asleep at an inopportune time? A time when you should be awake and doing something else. I remember falling asleep in the middle of Mr. Reimer's geography class. Grade 13, or OAC, Ontario Academic Credit, as it was called at the time. Strictly speaking, it's not falling asleep that I remember, it's waking up. It might not have been so bad, except I was sitting in the very front of the class. I was, at the time I had moved out, I was living on my own, working nights, tired, and evidently I fell deeply asleep right in the front of the class. What woke me was a giant slurp, which a couple moments later, I realized was me. Apparently, I had been drooling on my desk. Oops. Been embarrassing. And I discovered that three-ring binder paper is not real absorbent. Should have stayed awake. I was in class. Should have been paying attention. But I wasn't. I fell asleep. In the passage that we are looking at this morning, we're going to encounter Jesus' disciples falling asleep at an inopportune time, at a time when Jesus calls them to engage in prayer. Jesus will lead them up the Mount of Olives. They've enjoyed or celebrated the Passover meal together. He will tell them to pray, and instead of praying, they will fall asleep. Now, before we turn to our text and I read it with you this morning, let me remind you of the context where we find ourselves. Over the last three Sundays, we have joined Jesus and his disciples at a table in an upper room in a house in the city of Jerusalem. Jesus had stated earlier on in that encounter with his disciples that he had been really eager to share this meal with them before he suffered. They didn't know what that meant, but he knew that suffering was coming. At the meal, Jesus took symbols that were in part of the Passover celebration, bread and a cup of wine, and he invested in them new meaning. He took the bread and said, "This bread is my body given for you." The same way he took the cup and said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. Jesus announced while they were at dinner together, he announced that one of them, one of the 12, one of those men who had been with him for 3 years would soon betray him. Somehow, that turned into, from a discussion of who that might be, into an argument about which of them was the greatest. We listened as Jesus responded with grace and gentleness and patience, not rebuking them, but calling them to be different. Not like kings who lord it over others, who push their weight around. Not like those who do good to others for self-centered reasons, those called benefactors. But be like the one who serves. Be like Jesus. The passage we looked at last week, still at the table, we listened as Jesus warned his disciples of trouble that was on the way. Trouble that would come because Satan was after them. He was out to get them, to sift them. Trouble that would come because of their own lack of fidelity to Jesus. "Peter, you will deny knowing me 3 times, Jesus told Peter, despite his confidence that he would go to prison and even death with Jesus. Trouble that would come because the world that has the world would respond to them with great hostility and opposition in the future that lay immediately ahead. It's immediately on the heels of those warnings that we come to the text we're looking at this morning, Luke 22, verses 39 to 46. Follow along as I read. Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down, and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. When he rose from prayer and went back to the disciples, he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. Why are you sleeping? He asked them. Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. In the time we have together this morning, I want to do four things with you. First, I want to explore some of the particulars of Luke's account, the story as Luke recounts it to us. Second, I want us to consider Jesus' words to the disciples. Third, we'll focus our attention on Jesus himself, his prayer that stands at the center of this text. And then fourth, I want to spend a few minutes with you reflecting on the implications of this passage for our lives as readers of the text this morning. So first, the particulars of the story as Luke tells it. There are a number of differences between Luke's telling of this part of the Passion narrative and the accounts we find in the other synoptic Gospels, Matthew and Mark. For example, Luke tells us only that Jesus and his disciples went to the Mount of Olives. He does not include the specific detail that they went to the Garden of Gethsemane, which was on the Mount of Olives. Matthew and Mark both tell us that. Also, in both Matthew and Mark, Jesus singles out Peter, James, and John, invites them to come a little bit further than the other disciples with him, and then he goes on yet further. In Luke, we don't get that detail. Another distinction is that in both Matthew and Mark, they tell us that Jesus went off to pray three times, and he came back each time finding the disciples asleep. Luke does not tell us those multiple times. He simply says that Jesus came back and found them sleeping. It would seem that in Luke's account, there is a heightened emphasis on Jesus' prayer rather than on the disciples' failure. Something to bear in mind as we explore this account. By this time, Judas, one of the 12, the one who had entered into an agreement with Jesus' enemies to betray Jesus, with those men who wanted Jesus removed from the scene, wanted him dead, Judas is long gone. Soon he'll arrive with men coming to arrest Jesus. You may recall that an important part of his plan was that he could locate Jesus at a time when Jesus was away from the crowds. The religious leaders were scared of the crowds who still largely were positive towards Jesus. They didn't want to cause a riot. Jerusalem was full of pilgrims because it was the time of the Passover. And so Judas needed to know where Jesus would be. So it's significant that Luke tells us Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives. It seemed that Jesus and his disciples over their days in Jerusalem had a usual spot on the Mount of Olives that they went to, probably where they camped out over the course of these days. Judas knew the spot. It was their usual spot. At this point in Luke's account, we come to the first of two imperatives, two commands that Jesus issues to his followers. In short, Jesus says to them, pray. Pray. He says it here. He says it towards the end of our text. Bracketed by those commands in Luke's is Luke's brief account of Jesus practicing what he preaches. Jesus tells his disciples to pray. Jesus goes off. He kneels down and he prays. And then he comes back to his disciples and he tells them again to pray. He goes about a stone's throw beyond them, kneels down, and does what he is calling them to do. Now, it's at this point in Luke's account that we encounter a detail that's not found in the other gospel accounts. In verse 43, we read, an angel from heaven appeared to him, this Jesus, and strengthened him. It's interesting to be sure. And not the first time that an angel shows up to comfort Jesus. In Mark's telling of the story of Jesus facing the temptations, an angel, we read way back when Jesus' ministry was beginning, angels attended him. This messenger of his Father, this angel from heaven, comes and ministers to Jesus in the garden as he prays. Now, Michael Card describes this angel's mission as unsuccessful due to the fact that Jesus' anguish is intensified. I don't know that I'd agree with Michael Card, but it's interesting. This angel comes to strengthen him, but Jesus' anguish does increase. We read that Jesus is so gripped with anguish and stress that his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. Now, this is a real thing. Did I just run out of batteries? This is a real thing. A condition called, I'll read it, hematidrosis. It's what happens when a person under tremendous stress, tremendous anguish, where the capillaries near your sweat glands actually rupture and blood comes out through your sweat glands. This can happen to a human being when they are under tremendous, tremendous stress. Evidently, Jesus is experiencing a high level of anguish and stress as he kneels before his Father to pray. So let's turn from the particulars of the story to the second thing we wanted to look at, and that is Jesus' words to his followers. I've already noted that Jesus issues his disciples a command. He issues it twice, an imperative. In short, he says, pray. Pray. Verse 40, pray that you will not fall into temptation. At the close of our text, verse 46, the same command, get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. In both these instances, the verb is in the imperative. These are commands. Pray. Pray that you will not fall into temptation. Now, the word translated here as temptation can mean either temptation as in to sin, or it can mean a time of severe testing, which Jesus has also talked about, that they will face that. In light of Jesus' earlier warnings that trouble is coming, some take it to mean a time of severe testing. I don't think we need to distinguish. The reality is, I would contend with Leon Morris, who writes this, the disciples should seek to be preserved from both. They should pray so that they will not fall into temptation. They should pray that they will not fall when they face trials. At the end of the day, it's the same thing. They are to pray that they will not fall into sin. To fall when you face trials, to fall when you're tempted to sin, at the end of the day, it's the same thing. Clearly, though, Jesus wants his disciples to pray. And he seems equally clear that in Jesus' mind, Jesus understands that prayer is effective. Pray so that you will not fall into temptation. And we'll come back to the matter of prayer a little bit later this morning, but we do well to recognize the importance that Jesus places upon prayer at this point in the narrative. Jesus himself is about to go to the cross. Jesus himself is about to suffer. This is very nearly the last thing Jesus says to his disciples on this side of the grave. And he says, pray. Let's turn our attention from his words to the disciples to Jesus and his prayer, which lie at the heart of this text. Jesus leads his disciples to the Mount of Olives. He tells them to pray, and he goes off a stone's throw away, a short distance away from them. He leaves the men that he is closest with, men whom he called, men who have followed him for 3 years, his closest earthly friends. Jesus leaves them, and he goes off by himself, alone. He kneels down, and he prays. Luke shares with us what Jesus prays. He says, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. Leon Morris writes, Jesus' prayer reveals a natural shrinking from the awful death that lay ahead of him. The death Jesus was about to suffer would not only be horrifically painful physically. The Romans had intentionally invested as much in this death to inflict the most agony they could to a human being. But there was something more that Jesus was going to suffer, something far worse than even this horrific physical pain. Jesus says in his prayer, he says, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Jesus was about to receive a cup. Jesus was about to drink from that cup, if you will. What is that cup? What does that mean? What does this cup entail? We read through the Old Testament prophets, we will catch a glimpse. This language, this imagery is language that speaks of the wrath of God. God's just judgment upon sin. Not only is Jesus about to undergo an incredibly agonizing death physically, he is about to bear the judgment for sin. Just this week, in a conversation with a believer that I ran into elsewhere, made a comment about the theory of penal substitution understanding of the cross, this notion that on the cross Jesus bore the wrath of God. There are some, if you read widely, there are some who are offended at that idea. They even use words like, well, that's divine child abuse. They think that somehow it's this image of this angry, wrathful God lashing out in anger at this poor child, this son, Jesus. But I want to say to you today that is to misread Scripture. God's wrath, when we speak of God's wrath, it's not God losing his temper. See, if we think of God's wrath in terms of what we know of human wrath, then we see this out of control anger. That's not God's wrath. God's wrath is his settled opposition to sin. God is a holy God, and he must punish sin. God cannot stand sin, and so his wrath is his opposition to sin. But it's not that God somehow is wrathful and Jesus is loving, that God lashes out and Jesus cowers beneath that. No, God is one, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And God purposed this. It's out of God's love, God the Father, John 3:16, we know it. For God so loved the world. God's plan of redemption is about God's love for sinners. And Jesus, what we see here is Jesus the Son, not stepping in saying, whoa, 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 don't lash out at them. No, it's Jesus willingly saying, I will bear the wrath. I will bear the judgment that they deserve. Not only would Jesus suffer terribly physically, but Jesus will bear the wrath of God for our sin. He will drink the cup of divine wrath for us. Jesus, who had known only perfect intimacy with Father and Spirit, will soon hang on a cross. Suffering physically, but suffering forsakenness because he bears our sin. Paul speaks of this great exchange in 2 Corinthians 5. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. To be sin for us. Jesus takes on our wickedness. He takes on our rebellion. He takes on every foul thing that you and I have ever done. He takes that on. He becomes sin. So that through faith in him, we might become the righteousness of God. This marvelous exchange. But for Jesus, this was agony. And he willingly drinks this cup, drinks it right to the bottom, drinks every last drop. He bears our sin. He becomes our sin. And he will bear God forsakenness. In Mark's gospel, he cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? As his Father turns away in his holiness, God cannot stand sin, but out of his love, God moved to save us. N.T. Wright writes this, Jesus knew that his death would carry with it the full horror of darkness. God forsakenness. This is why Jesus was in such anguish. This is why Jesus sweats drops of blood. He knows what lies immediately ahead of him. And so he prays, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. But Jesus' prayer does not end there with those words. He prays on, yet not my will, but yours be done. Yet not my will, but yours be done. Jesus did not here on the Mount of Olives, here he did not drink the cup of God's wrath, but it was here that he wrestled with what lay ahead. It was here that he committed himself to drink it. Not my will. Leon Morris writes, the real battle was fought here. Joel Green writes, Jesus' struggle on the Mount of Olives is presented by Luke as the watershed in the Passion narrative, the critical point at which faithfulness to the divine will is embraced definitively in the strenuousness of prayer. Here we see Jesus crying out to his Father in anguish about what he is about to go through, but surrendering himself fully to the Father. He would do what they had, as Father, Son, and Spirit, purposed together for him to do. He would lay down his life out of love for sinful humanity. He would die the death that you and I deserve. He would drink the cup of God's divine wrath so that through faith in him, we might be saved. Let's turn fourthly to the implications of this passage for our lives this morning. What does this mean for you and for me? What response does this passage call for? On the one hand, answering that is fairly straightforward. Jesus here issues an imperative. Pardon me. He says, pray. He commands his followers to pray. He sets an example for his followers by himself praying. And it seems very clear from Jesus' command, this imperative, that he sees prayer as effective. Pray so that you will not fall into temptation. In other words, prayer is an essential aspect of following Jesus, an essential aspect of discipleship. Now, to say that prayer is an essential aspect of the Christian life is to state what most of us, at least, would agree to be true. Philip Yancey interviewed a bunch of, he says, ordinary people about prayer, and here's what he subsequently wrote. He said, many of those I talked to experienced prayer more as a burden than as a pleasure. They regarded it as an important, even paramount, and felt guilty about their failure, blaming themselves. Perhaps many of us here this morning would share those sentiments. We would acknowledge that prayer is paramount, that it is an essential aspect of following Jesus, and yet when it comes to prayer, we would be racked with guilt and a sense of failure and inadequacy. So here's a question I want to ask you. What is Jesus' intention this morning? Is it to ratchet up guilt over our failure, over our inability, over our inadequacy? Does he want us to feel the weight of that failure so that we get motivated and get our act together? Or, through this passage, might Jesus want to reveal something to us about the heart of prayer, something that will transform our understanding of prayer and lead to transformation in our practice of prayer? In his book titled Prayer, Philip Yancey writes this, most of my struggles in the Christian life circle around the same two themes. Why doesn't God act the way we want God to? And why don't I act the way God wants me to? prayer, he says. Prayer is the precise point where those themes converge. Themes of God doing what I want him to do, or me not doing what he wants him to do. Here's a question we need to ask. Is prayer fundamentally about bending God to our will? Or is it fundamentally about our will being bended to God's? Jesus on the Mount of Olives prayed, "Yet not my will, but yours be done." Prayer is not about us coming to God with our lists of all the things we want him to do for us. Yes, he invites us to come with our petitions, with our requests. But prayer is not about simply coming to God with our to-do lists for him. It's not about trying to bend God to our will. It's about surrendering our will to God's. Do you remember how Jesus taught his disciples to pray? Our Father in heaven. He begins by imploring us to lift our eyes from ourselves to him, to see God in his glory, in his holiness. Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. You are holy. You are majestic. You are awesome. You are creator of all things. You are the beginning and the end. You hold all things in your hands. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Father, it's about what you are doing. It's about your kingdom. It's about the unfolding of your will, not mine. Jesus teaches his disciples to pray by lifting their eyes up. As Jesus models here, not my will, but yours be done. Prayer, rightly understood, rightly practiced, restores our vision of reality, our vision of what is true, that God is gloriously enthroned above all of creation, that God is unfolding his redemptive plan, that God is King of kings and Lord of lords. It reminds us that our lives are fleeting, that they are but a breath. And yet that does not make us insignificant, because we are reminded that God has created us as men and women, young and old, as his image bearers, to reflect his character, his likeness, his goodness, his grace in this, his creation, for the purpose of his glory. And out of love for us, he has acted to redeem us, to restore us, to rescue us from our sin, to rescue us from our rebellion, to forgive us for all our wickedness, and to give us the gift of perfection. Prayer restores our vision of reality, of what is true. In prayer, to be sure, we talk to God, we talk with God. Prayer is more than simply coming to God with our lists. It's more than just putting in our perfunctory time. It's learning to pay attention to God. With the psalmist declares, "Be still and know that I am God." Prayer is about being attentive to God, being attentive to what is real and true about God, and about me, about you, about our world. Philip Yancey writes this, "Prayer has become for me much more than a shopping list of requests to present to God. It has become a realignment of everything. I pray to restore the truth of the universe, to gain a glimpse of the world and of me through the eyes of God. In prayer, I shift my point of view away from my own selfishness. Prayer is the act of seeing reality from God's point of view." What we see in this text, what we see in the example of Jesus in his own prayer, is the alignment of his will with the Father's will. That is what prayer is about, brothers and sisters. And it is precisely that that will enable us to avoid temptation. Only when our will is aligned with the Father's will. What, after all, is sin? Sin is living according to our own will. So it is that alignment with the Father's will that leads us in obedience, that leads us into holiness. Now, lots more could be said about prayer. We don't have time. Let me just say a couple things. But I'm going to say a couple things. First, when we think of prayer, we need to remember that we are invited to come to God just as we are. That we come to God not as experts, not as those who are competent. Richard Foster writes this: our problem is that we assume prayer is something to master the way we master algebra or auto mechanics. I haven't mastered either of those either, but prayer is not something we master. Prayer is something we enter into as we are. We come broken. We come sinful. We come hurting. We come with questions. We come with no need to hide. How silly is it to try and hide from God? He knows us better than we know ourselves. So we are invited in prayer to approach God as we are, honestly, humbly, without pretense. We come to Him and invite Him to meet us where we are. We acknowledge our desperate need for His grace, His mercy, His redemptive work. We can acknowledge the fact that right now our will is not in alignment with His. We acknowledge our wounds, we acknowledge our hurts, we acknowledge our questions, our struggles. We can just come as we are. And we surrender. We invite Him to give us courage and strength to surrender. We ask Him to bend our will that it might align with His. We learn to pray like Jesus prayed, "Not my will, but yours be done." That's what prayer is about. And the second thing I want to say is prayer is about friendship with God. Prayer ought not be something that's simply on our to-do list, something we have to endure, something burdensome. It is entering into a friendship with God. Quoting Yancey once more, he says, "Though my needs may drive me to prayer, there I come face to face with my greatest need, an encounter with God's own self." We were made for God. We were made to know Him. We were made to love Him, to receive His love, to receive His grace, to walk in fellowship with Him. And it is only in that place that we will experience rest. It is only in that place of friendship with God that we will experience joy and freedom. And friendship with God, like any other friendship, it's not transactional, it's a relationship. It's not, "I'll do this and you give me what I want." No, there's simply joy in being together. Like any friendship, it takes time. Time spent together. Time pouring out our hearts in honesty. And also time being quiet, just listening. I don't know how many of you have ever practiced listening prayer, just being silent with God. But any other relationship requires that we listen. That we share honestly and that we listen. And if that's true, we need to understand the things in our world, in our lives, that conspire against prayer. If prayer means friendship with God, and friendship with God means time and space, we need to recognize that our near constant busyness, and motion, that the near constant noise in our world conspires against prayer. If we are going to be men and women who grow to love fellowshipping with God in prayer, it will require that we carve out a block of time. Maybe it's 5 minutes. Maybe it's 5 minutes of silence, walking, or sitting in a room, listening, inviting God to move, to speak, to remind us of what is true. When I guess I was younger too, when my boys were younger, we would often, as a family, often, we would periodically walk in the ravine that's not too far from here. And it was a ravine that I often would go wander through and pray. Just wander for an hour. And my boys grew up calling it the prayer forest. Blessed my heart to hear that. I'd love to stand here before you today as someone who's competent in prayer, but honesty says, you know what, I've allowed the busyness even of stuff I'm trying to do for God to push those leisurely wanderings with God off my calendar more times than I'd care to admit. If we are going to grow in friendship with God, we need to make it a priority to find time to simply be with Him, to invite Him to remind us of what's true, to pour out our hearts to Him, to listen for His voice. Jesus returns to His disciples and He finds them asleep. They fail to do what He calls them to do. Here's the glory of the gospel. Every one of us fails to do what we are called to do. Jesus alone succeeds where we fail. Jesus alone cries out to the Father in the garden. Jesus alone surrenders His will fully to the will of the Father. Jesus alone will go to the cross and He will die for your sin and mine. Jesus alone. So this morning, the message isn't get motivated, pull up your socks and pray, people. It's that we need to rest in what Christ has done. We need to celebrate what Christ alone has done. And it's as we receive His grace, as we recognize that He has clothed us with His perfection, that He loves us and has invited us and brought us into a relationship with Him, a friendship with God, that He will move in our hearts. He will put in our hearts a greater longing for that intimacy with Him. He will invite us into those times of prayer where we can just be honest, no pretense, no hiding, just honesty before Him, time with Him, seeking Him. Lord, that You would transform our affections, that You would transform our will, that You would align our will with Yours, Father. May we, by His grace and for His glory, be so captured by His love and His grace that He would transform us into men and women who grow in prayer, not to perfection. We will never be competent in this. We will never be experts. But we can, in this, experience the presence, the intimacy of God, and see Him at work in us, transforming us, bending our will to His, making us into people who reflect Him for His glory. Amen.